Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 28, 2017. This is the first of a series of four talks on the meaning of awakening in the context of Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So today is the first of a series of four talks on what it means to awaken to each of the Four Noble Truths. Of course, that's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma, is to develop a profound understanding of these four truths. It's the very first thing that he taught, and it's everything he taught after that was taught in the context of these Four Noble Truths. So in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sutta the Buddha ever taught, he describes awakening very simply and directly. In relation to the first noble truth, the noble truth of dukkha has been comprehended. To the second noble truth, the noble truth of the origination of dukkha has been abandoned, meaning craving and clinging has been abandoned. In relation to the third noble truth, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha has been experienced. We've actually had that awakening experience. When the Buddha describes awakening, he describes it as unbound or released from clinging. Again, very simple and direct. In relation to the fourth noble truth, the Buddha states the noble truth of the white practice leading to the cessation of dukkha has been developed the Eightfold Path. The Buddha never taught anything else outside of this. Again, it said that he gave over 84,000 discourses over the course of his 45-year teaching career, and that number just simply means a whole heck of a lot. And everything he taught, I know I say this over and over again, everything he taught was in relation to those Four Noble Truths. He never taught anything else. He never taught another path. He never taught anything that was terribly complicated. All of those discourses that he gave were in relation, almost solely, were situationally related, meaning it had to do with what was going on with the group in front of him, maybe the town that he was passing through. Mostly it was questions that were put directly to the Buddha. Yes, I agree. They didn't, because they didn't quite understand what was going on at the moment. The Four Noble Truths are traditionally listed as life is stressful, life is dukkha. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. That cessation of dukkha is possible, and the Eightfold Path is a path leading to the cessation of dukkha or stress. The purpose of the Buddha's entire teaching is to develop the Eightfold Path and abandon the origination of human suffering and confusion. The entire Buddha's teaching is summarized in the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha taught that by abandoning clinging in all its forms, most importantly clinging to wrong views rooted in ignorance, that the skillful means of the cessation of stress could be developed. The eight factors of the Eightfold Path provide a practical framework of mindful living that develops the right knowledge, wisdom, and ethical behavior necessary to methodically and purposely recognize and put aside the distraction of stress. Another rather long sentence that probably could have been broken up a little bit better. The Eightfold Path is there so that if we integrate it into our lives, we can recognize where our wrong views, where our... maybe that fan will balance out, but if not, we'll just turn it off. So that our wrong views, our views rooted in ignorance, could be recognized. A mind that is rooted in ignorance is prone, conditioned to ignore anything that would challenge that ignorance. It's kind of the essence of ignorance. So the Buddha realized that. He realized that the common human problem was this wrong views rooted in ignorance or conditioned mind, deluded mind. How does a deluded mind know that it's deluded? Remember in the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha talks about getting caught into this feedback loop. You just don't understand what's going on. Your self-identity is stuck in wrong views, and you just can't see the truth, even if it's staring you in the face. So he developed an Eightfold Path precisely for that reason. Beginning in and rooted in concentration as developed in meditation, and then framed by the refined mindfulness of the other seven factors, we're able to recognize our own ignorance. It really is the whole point of the Eightfold Path. And once a well-concentrated mind is recognizing its ignorance, it will simply abandon it. The Buddha never taught to recognize your ignorance and start analyzing where it comes from and start blaming this and blaming that person, blame yourself. He always and consistently said, recognize ignorance and simply abandon it. I tell you that that inference or direct instruction is in half of the sutras he's ever given. The Buddha's words on awakening. And this, monks, and I guess this is early in the Sangha, but all that, and this, monks and nuns, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha, precisely this noble eightfold path, beginning with right view. Right view is understanding the origins of dukkha, understanding the cessation of dukkha, understanding the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. Right view is both the conceptual beginning, this is my words now, right view is both the conceptual beginning to the path leading to the cessation of stress, and ultimately the understanding, the vision that encompasses the entire Buddha's teaching. Another way that the Buddha would describe awakening in relation to right view, he would say, an awakened right view is understanding stress. Again, pointing right back to the beginning of the Four Noble Truths. Any questions on this so far? It's very simple and direct, isn't it? And it always comes back to the Four Noble Truths. Right intention is having the intention of renunciation, having the intention to remain free of ill will, having the intention to remain harmless. Right intention is mindfully turning away from the things leading to stress and confusion and mindfully engaging in integrating the Eightfold Path. Right intention, in a little bit more simpler terms, is recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging. Right speech is, these are all my words now, right speech is abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from hurtful speech, abstaining from idle chatter and gossip. Being mindful of right speech develops a deep awareness of thoughts, words, and deeds that would further cause stress and confusion. Right speech is free of grasping, clinging, aversion, or expressing wrong views. Many, many people, I bet you everyone here in this room would say that their beginning understanding of the Eightfold Path started with being mindful of right speech. Isn't that true? You recognize when your speech is outside of the parameters and you simply and gently bring it back into right speech. When the Buddha described being mindful, he taught mindfulness in this very specific way. To be mindful when engaged in the unskillful or wrong aspects of the Eightfold Path and enter and remain or practice the right aspects. And the path is really that simple and direct because it is in recognizing the unskillful aspects of the path, we're recognizing the I-making that we're engaged in, the self-centered thinking, the self-referential thinking. Right action is abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct. As with right speech, right action is free of any self-centered desire and develops harmony and equanimity. Right livelihood is abstaining from dishonest livelihood, not engaging in what can cause harm to others, avoiding the sale of intoxicants, enhancing life with right livelihood. Right livelihood is specifically remaining harmless in the manner of earning a living and contributing to the common good. I remember when I first came across the Eightfold Path and I got to right livelihood, and it confused me a little bit because I thought that isn't right livelihood addressed in right speech and right action? Doesn't it cover it? Until I realized and read a little bit more into the suttas, that the Buddha recognized that otherwise honest men and women, when it came to putting food on the table, would sometimes do things that were a little bit outside of that. And you can think about that. The Buddha grew up in times that were just as desperate as our times, maybe in some ways a little more so. And so it's understandable that people would compromise their own ethics when you got to feed the kids, you know, you got to pay the rent. But even that, and again, this is not a moral ethic or moral teaching where if you steal a loaf of bread, you're going to go straight to hell. But it's to recognize that we've engaged in the Dhamma, and even doing that is going to lead to more confused and deluded thinking. So again, it's not, of course, it's wrong to steal on any level. But again, it's not that you're going to get punished for it because of some grand spiritual system. It's simply an aspect of eye-making, isn't it? To be recognized and abandoned. And that became very clear for me. I was in the construction business for most of my life, and I knew a lot of people that were otherwise good and honest men and women, but they're always shaving corners. And it was almost accepted, and that's really part of one of the problems with our corporate culture, and even more so in certain other countries that I won't even mention, that for the corporate good, it's okay to do anything. And again, I won't say it, but most of you know there's a few countries, one specifically, that is part of their culture, that you do anything for the bottom line. And so when I started understanding this, my understanding of why the Buddha included right livelihood in here is so important. So we recognize it even in the workplace, even what we're doing to support ourselves and our family. Right, number six, right effort is generating effort and intention to abandon cultivation of unskillful qualities and generating effort and intention to abandon unskillful qualities already present. Right effort is generating effort and intention to cultivate skillful qualities and generating effort and intention to maintain skillful qualities. Again, a little bit confusing. Right effort is simply putting in the effort and the mindfulness to recognize when we're engaged in unskillful activities, and if they arise, to abandon it. And also to put in the effort to, this is almost like in order to break a bad habit, you have to develop a good habit, to start developing skillful qualities mindfully and intentionally. And when they've arisen, to all actually recognize that. It's important to recognize as we're developing the path. That's part of right effort. And then right effort relates to the entire Eightfold Path in the way that we have to put some effort in meditating and also developing our understanding of the Eightfold Path. Right effort also points to helping to maintain focus. In other words, it's okay to be involved in other wholesome practices, even so-called spiritual practices. Excuse me. But right effort would guide us in maintaining the purity of the Dhamma as something separate. In other words, not trying to combine all the wholesome activities we do and calling it Dhamma practice, because we can often overemphasize things that, just to use an example, we might also be engaged in yoga, which is a very wholesome and healthy practice. The philosophy is slightly different, and if we put too much emphasis on that and consider it Dhamma practice, we can lose sight of the Eightfold Path. But if we recognize that they're really two separate things, then we can develop both fully, and one won't affect the other. Is that clear? So there's all kinds of wholesome practices that we can say are part of the Dhamma. We might enjoy chanting different Buddhist schools. That's not something the Buddha taught. If you enjoy chanting or you find it helpful, fine, but recognize it's not part of what the Buddha taught. And that'll just maintain the purity of the Dhamma. Number seven, right mindfulness is holding in mind the present moment and the qualities of awakening in relation to the Four Noble Truths. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, we went through this a while ago. Was it not, I don't remember if it was Tuesday or Saturday. Was it? Okay. So we went through this just to remind you all of the Buddha's words. Remain focused on the breath in the body in and of itself, meaning don't bring any other practices in. It's enough to simply be mindful of the breath as the breath is presenting itself. Ardent, aware, and mindful. Putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. It simply means to stop, to recognize when your thoughts are attached to things in the world, recognize and come back to the sensation of breathing. Remaining focused on feelings in and of themselves. Ardent and aware and mindful. Putting away greed and distress with reference to the world. Remaining focused on the mind or thinking process in and of itself. Ardent, aware, and mindful. Putting away greed and distress with reference to the world. So again, the Buddha's using a lot of words to say in meditation, when feelings come up and distract us, they're distracting us because they're clinging to something in the world or something self-referential. That's an aspect of craving also. Simply be mindful of it and come back to the sensation of breathing. When it's just thoughts that we're caught up in again, telling ourselves that same story over and over again, recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. That's being ardent and aware and mindful. And these are the only instructions that Buddha ever gave on meditation. Don't get into the thoughts, just recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. And then this last relates to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, and that the last instruction I give on meditation before we come out of it Notice the condition of your mind, be at peace with your mind. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. However your mind is presenting itself in the moment, whether it's on our cushions or off, recognize it. Don't insist that it be any different than it is, even if it's a troublesome mind state, and just be at peace with it, because of impermanence, you understand that it's going to change. The longer we struggle with it or insist that our minds be different, the more we condition our minds to be exactly that way. The Buddha's words on that. Remaining focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, aware, and mindful, putting away greed and distress with reference to the world, specifically into a whatever mind state we're in. Greed and distress would be insisting that that mind state be different than it is, whether it's mild upset, extreme anguish, or extreme happiness or elation over what's occurring. Because wanting more of that mind state is greed too, isn't it? We're so conditioned to think that we should cultivate only pleasant mind states and hold on to them. That's another very subtle but powerful aspect of conditioned thinking that then creates stress when that mind state isn't there. The eighth factor, right intention, is meditation that develops two qualities, tranquility and insight. In the Vijayabhagaya Sutta, the Buddha describes the two qualities of right meditation, the Buddha's words. These two qualities have a share in clear knowing, which two, tranquility or shamatha, and insight, vipassana. When tranquility is developed, what purpose does it serve? The mind is developed, and when the mind is developed, what purpose does it serve? Passion is abandoned. When insight is developed, what purpose does that serve? Discernment is developed. And when discernment is developed, what purpose does it serve? It is abandoned. It takes both of those. So again, there's one of the most popular modern movements is focused mostly on insight. I'm not putting it down, but that's what's developed. And it was developed specifically, or it had its roots in Burma, for a meditator who had achieved a pretty high level of understanding, but he wanted to teach meditation to everybody, to workers, mostly to government workers. And he realized that they didn't have the time, and I think he probably judged this erroneously, but he said they didn't have the time to really get into the whole Dhamma. So let me just teach kind of a hybridized type of meditation practice that government workers could take to in 10 or 15 minutes during lunch hour. And from that grew what is today the modern insight meditation movement. And again, it had, the roots were very altruistic and compassionate and possibly understanding. But I think we found here that meditation alone, and it goes against the Buddhist teaching, meditation alone is not something that will likely develop the entire Eightfold Path, which means leading to awakening. Any meditation method will bring a certain manner of peace and calm, at least while you're doing it. And you could do that just sitting quietly, really, closing your eyes. To develop the entire Eightfold Path requires the correct meditation method, practice in the right framework, and then developing the entire Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, defiled by passion, the mind is not released. Defiled by ignorance, discernment is not developed. Thus from the fading of passion is their awareness release, meaning the mind, you actually understand the release, you're mindful of it. From the fading of ignorance is the discernment of release. My words now, just to explain what's coming next. From the Samyutta Nikaya 45.8, the Buddha describes the levels of meditative absorption or jhanas developed Vishamatha Vipassana meditation. Samadhi is typically translated to mean concentration, but it is more accurate to understand samadhi as a non-distracted state. Referring to the first jhana is remaining free of distraction by sensuality, ease, and sense contact. Let me read it again. Remaining free of distraction by sensuality and sense contact, remaining free of distraction by unskillful mental qualities, meaning we've recognized those and abandoned them. Given a few talks on the jhanas and samadhi. Jhanas are often presented as very advanced levels of meditation, and the Buddha simply uses jhanas to describe things that occur, at least the first three jhanas, to every one of us during meditation practice. And he taught it so that we would simply recognize it, not look at the jhanas as something to achieve, which would be another distraction. The Buddha continues, remaining free of distraction by sensuality and sense contact, remaining free of distraction by unskillful mental qualities, entering remaining in the first shaman, rapture and pleasure born from samadhi, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation, meaning insight. With a tranquil mind, entering and remaining in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of samadhi. Rapture, did everybody know what that means? Rapture is kind of a misunderstood, maybe an out-of-date word. And it's usually misapplied. Rapture in this sense means deep absorption in what's occurring. Maybe using the way it's commonly is being enraptured with something, usually how it's presented, simply means that you're well focused on what's occurring. Maybe the apocalyptic story in the Bible about the rapture's coming. Think about all those things that it describes. You're going to be well focused on it. So it means just that. Getting onto the third jhana, with the fading of rapture, remaining equanimous, mindful, and alert, gaining pleasure with a sensation of breathing in the body, entering, remaining in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. So we've all had that experience where we deepen our concentration and we get to the point where we're just mindful of our breath and our body's just relaxing. We find it pleasant. There's no distraction. Even if it's just for a moment, we're in that third jhana. Has everybody had that experience at least momentarily?
You describe the word
equanimity? Equanimity or equanimous. It simply means that there's no disturbance in the mind at all. The mind is balanced, it's at peace. And again, it might just be for a moment, but an awakened mind is equanimous all the time. There's no disturbance. Another way of saying that is when you're at peace with your life unfolding, no matter what's occurring, your mind is resting in equanimity. It's not recognizing that something should be different than it is. Clear? Entering, remaining in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding, abandoning pleasure and pain. See anyway. Due to the renunciation of pleasure and pain, entering and remaining in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. That last line means that we're not, our mind isn't bouncing back and forth from seeking pleasure and aversion to pain at all. It's simply residing with what's occurring as our life unfolds. And again, that fourth jhana is something that most of us have experienced during meditation, and many of us have taken it off our cushions and had that experience even for a moment. So the Buddha is not, in describing the fourth jhana, he's not describing it as a permanent awakened state. It's simply a reference to a permanent awakened state. Onwards here. This is the way of liberation and freedom. It is a moral, ethical, and concentrated framework that systematically develops the qualities of awakening, of full human maturity. Once awakened, the veil of delusion is gone and clear and unadorned knowledge and vision is present. The Buddha's words. As soon as this knowledge and vision of mind was of mind, M-I-N-E, was truly pure, then I did claim to have directly awakened to this rightly self-awakened, that is unexcelled in the cosmos. Buddha is describing his own awakening. Knowledge and vision arose in me. Unprovoked is my release, meaning there's nothing forcing it, there's nothing generating it except his own rightly self-awakened efforts. The Buddha continues, unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. So again, not to get into the talk on karma and rebirth, the Buddha is very specifically stating the purpose of awakening is to cease creating the conditions that would give rise to further births rooted in ignorance, whether it's the next moment, giving birth to the next moment rooted in ignorance, or a future life rooted in ignorance. This is my last birth. For me, there is now no further becoming. Remember the teachings on becoming, as it relates to dependent origination. Each moment holds the potential to either that if it's rooted in ignorance, rooted in wrong views, to become further ignorant. Or if it's framed by the Eightfold Path, then the potential in each moment is to become awakened, to become fully mature. That's what the Buddha is referring to. In relation to his awakening, now there is no possibility of a moment that would further becoming ignorant. He's awakened. The difficulty in developing the qualities of awakening are due entirely to the confusion and distraction of stress and the reactive and discursive nature of clinging. The intellectual knowledge of the Eightfold Path will not lead to the development qualities leading to cessation. The experience or the integration of the Eightfold Path will. Incorporating the moral, ethical, and concentration factors of the Eightfold Path develops the experience of the cessation of suffering. As a direct result of wholehearted practice, the path leading to the cessation of stress is developed. There's about 25% more of that article left if you want to read it, but it's on the website. But that describes what it means to awaken to the first noble truth. So, any questions on this and specifically how what it means to awaken to understanding? Then we'll go around and read. Okay, we're good. Good to see you, Tim. Jen, good to see you.
Hi, guys. This was good. This was a good refresher because I haven't been here and I've been in meditations and it's getting shaved off in the morning. So it's a good time to have reinvigorate. Amazing when you just hear like a few words of it, kind of gets rid of all the mental compost.
Yeah, it just brings you right back to it. May I ask, Vera, Diane, again, thanks for watching Bodhi. Diane watched the dog while we were on retreat. It's pretty subtle. The minutes is kind of falling away, shaving minutes off of it. And it seems perfectly reasonable when you decide to do so.
Right.
Again, the only reason I'm bringing it up is to point out that's the framework of the Eightfold Path helps remind us that it's a good idea.
Right.
Good to see this one. Kevin, good to see you.
It's really, to me, it's easy to know it intellectually. And to try to live in meditation can occur in that mind. But then to expand it to life off the cushion is difficult. And I think it's a difficulty for all of us.
Yeah.
And I think it comes from still that I make. Sometimes difficult to be at peace with the state of mind. I think my eye judges if I'm not peaceful, if my mind is troubled, then I'm not happy with myself. You know? And that, you know, I think that gets to be that vicious cycle. It's difficult to, well, it comes and goes.
Thank you. You're so right to recognize that it's eye making. It says that any mind state should be different. And think about the conditioning that we've all developed that insists that my mind be only one certain way when it can't be. And when it's not, we react to that. And what are we reacting to? We're reacting to our own conditioned mind. And you see the feedback loop in that. Instead of simply being at peace with whatever is occurring. And when we can do that and our minds, the quality of our mind is accurately framed by right view, then we know that whatever we're feeling is also appropriate. Meaning, all an awakened mind is calm and at peace, a mind of equanimity, does not mean that it's a robotic mind that doesn't respond to what's occurring. It's simply at peace and in an appropriate way to what's occurring. And as you're describing it, as you recognize it in yourself, that this is a quality of mind that is agitating, but I'm at peace with it, you're directly training your mind to be that way, to be an awakened mind, to be at peace with what's occurring. And it, again, we need the framework of the Eightfold Path to recognize the I making in each situation and come back to just being present with what's occurring. Thank you. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you? I'm glad you're here this morning. And that is the way to, and anywhere along that, the road of distraction, you know, whether it's a million distractions into the original distraction, so much so we might even forgot what has been so upsetting us to our minds. Yeah, we, at any point, we can say, I'm reacting to my mind, be at peace with what's occurring. And certainly in that situation, what is appropriate is sadness. Of course it is. And we recognize very clearly the problem of continual reaction to it. So the whole thing is unpleasant, but good for you for seeing it. I'm so glad you're there. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it gets better, or the relief or the change in quality of mind occurs more quickly, or at least more gently, by not judging, by just being at peace. Again, it doesn't, and I know you see this very clearly, it doesn't say we should run away from any feeling. In fact, it allows us to be mindfully present with whatever is occurring and being and understanding that it's appropriate in this moment too. That's part of it. And again, it's not just a sorrowful feeling or any of that. It can also be a feeling of great elation. That it's simply what's occurring, but not hold on to that either. I want more of it. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm glad you're here this morning. Debbie, good to see you.
Well, that's a
Thank you.
Yeah, it's the mindful acceptance of things as they are that brings the cessation of reaction. When the Buddha described aging as part of dukkha, he's really not saying that aging itself is dukkha, although it is. It's the reaction to aging, or even the more extreme view is that it doesn't occur, and all the things that we do to think that we're going to live forever, the problems that I have. But as we start recognizing that we're aging and the end's getting closer, most people will react pretty strongly to that. And the acceptance of it allows us to be present, even as we're, not that you are, but even as I'm getting on in years, it's just what's occurring. And the real importance to that in relation to the Dhamma is realizing that, yeah, time is limited. You know, you better get to awakening, because you don't know when the cow's going to get you.
Well,
again, you're describing even more accurately dukkha. As a Buddha would consider, would continue his description of dukkha, one of the things that he would say is regret. And so all of that becomes a huge distraction from what's occurring, isn't it? Thank you for bringing that up. It's maybe a not entirely joyful experience, but a profound one. Thank you, Debbie. Lorna, good to see you. Good week, you know, and that's sort of
to live through it like Dharma coming through it like. You really don't know sometimes if you've just had a week where you haven't had any stress anyway, or you've just dealt with what comes along in more of a, you know, accepting way. So you don't deny me wishing for different or not for wrong way. And I don't really know which way it is, but I find a very comfortable way. Much learning, and incorporate so much learning from the Dharma in those 4 days. It's very, very, very worthwhile time to spend up there. You can get up there and just do your thing. It's really, really beneficial.
Thank you. And that's as it should be. You know, again, the reason why I don't run silent retreats as there's no opportunity to teach, but even more importantly, it, at least as much learning took place within the Sangha as you were just living through those 4 days framed by the Eightfold Path is as important as the teachings themselves, I think. And it very similar to how the first Sangha lived day by day within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And that last year, this past week, knowing that you're living within the framework of the Dhamma is part of the Dhamma. You know it. You know? And so you're having that experience that you know, you're realizing the effects of your right effort. So good for you. Liz, good to see you. Speak up just a little bit. Yeah. Thank you. And I mean, and I think you're all describing right effort too. I think you got to do it. And if you do it, it actually develops. It should make sense. Siddhartha knew what he was talking about. Any other questions or comments about this awakening to dukkha? So again, this is the first of 4 talks. Next week, we'll talk about awakening in relation to the Second Noble Truth and continue from there. The 2 announcements. One is the Dana dinner on November 21st, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. Info on the website, Cross River Meditation website, and what to bring in, et cetera, et cetera. I hope you all come. Bring your friends. Our Dana project is the Rare Learning Cooperative. And one of our Sangha members, Mary Beth, who is on retreat, is a principal, not the principal, of that alternative high school in Flemington. It's just a great idea, great project, and there's info on the website about that, about how we can get involved. But basically, whatever you think you'd like to teach or offer to the kids there, high school age kids, write a paragraph or two. It doesn't necessarily have to be what you teach for a living, but it could be. And we're going to put it in a catalog, and Mary Beth will keep it to school. So if the kids express some interest in a certain thing, you go and teach. Maybe it's one class, maybe it's a series of classes, however you want to frame it. And then we're also going to get involved in some practical ways. We're going to have the place needs some paint, so we're going to get a painting party together on Saturday or something. Do that for them. A lot of the big pictures from the retreat, thank you, Liz, are up. And also the talks from the retreat are posted on the website too on coming-buddha.com. I think that's it. So let's finish as we always do with metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. Thank you. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past, excuse me, or to the future, or what have arisen from our talk today. In the Buddha's words on metta, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud, demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again to this one. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.